Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In her bestseller, Room, writer Emma Donahue imagined what life would be like for a little boy born into captivity to a mother who'd been kidnapped and sexually assaulted. And in her new novel, Frog Music, she's imagined a possible solution to a very real murder, one that took place in California in 1876. That crime was never solved, but Emma Donahue has gone through historical records to write what might have happened. We welcome Emma Donahue to this week's book show. A pleasure having you on the program.
My pleasure.
After the incredible success of Room, what were you looking to write?
Something that would not appear to be trying to grab those readers all over again. I absolutely hate it when authors milk their success by coming up with a slightly stirred mixture of the same ingredients. So I thought, oh, great, the novel I'm already planning to write from years ago when I first got the idea will be set in 1870s San Francisco. It'll be a murder mystery full of vice and debauchery. I thought it'll be nothing at all like the child's eye perspective of Room. What I hadn't really expected was that it would turn out to have a central plot all about a woman searching for her missing baby. So actually the two have a certain preoccupation with parenting. But it was a very different cultural world. So it was a great break for me after Room. And in particular, because Room had featured such a noble, brave young mother, it was great this time writing from the point of view of Blanche, who's really a naturally selfish and slutty young mother who has to go through a lot of changing before she can find it in herself to love her child. So it was a very refreshing contrast.
Before we talk about Blanche, bring us to the summer of 1876 and San Francisco. At that time of what you wanted to deal with, I assume the heat, the smallpox, the disease, those were all ingredients you wanted to include.
It was an extraordinary summer in reality. Yes, they had this bizarre heat wave. It wasn't the typical San Francisco weather at all. And they were also being plagued with smallpox, which was usually a winter disease if it came at all. So it was just a summer of grueling conditions. And also, there was a lot of tension, a lot of, you know, white people beating up Chinese in the streets. So the city was really riven with racial tensions. And my main characters are all real people. They're all French people who were living in Chinatown in San Francisco and living on by the arts of pleasure, shall we say. So the real murder that inspired this happened on a very on the grimy outskirts of San Francisco in a tiny little four-room shack just where the train tracks cross over the county line. And a young woman called Jenny Bonnet, who was a professional frog catcher, so she caught frogs for the restaurant trade, she was gunned down through a window. And the other woman, Blanche the dancer, was the only survivor of the attack. So I tell my whole story through Blanche's eyes from before the murder to just after it.
And Blanche's eyes are quite fascinating to see a story through.
She was a wonderful point of view character because she's not the naturally thoughtful, reflective, quiet sort of author substitute who often tells stories in novels. She's very full-bodied, very physical. She adores sex. I thought for once I should write about a prostitute who likes sex rather than one who hates it, just for a change. And also, frankly, it makes it a more interesting story to see if I could set her up as, you know, the good time girl who says yes to everything and then find moments in the novel where she suddenly decides she wants to say no. I thought it gave the novel a lot more sort of moral heft. And Blanche was also a great point of view because being recently from France and working class, she's got this whole bohemian set of values. She doesn't believe in marriage. She believes in freedom and, you know, life is too short to drink bad wine. That's the kind of principle she lives by. So a very a narrator with an awful lot of really modern qualities. Living in a highly modern city, which was very multicultural. People ate out in restaurants all the time instead of cooking their own food. It was a very modern life, even though it was the 1870s.
And she starts to question her choices, as you indicated. There's a point where she starts to ask herself whether she has made the proper decisions in her life.
Yes, in particular, Blanche and her lover Arthur had a baby and they farmed this baby out. They gave it to somebody else to look after full time and they just visited it every now and then. This might strike us as a really horrible choice, but it was very common in those days. There were a lot of lifestyles that didn't allow for the raising of children. In San Francisco, it was terribly hard to get live-in servants even. So this kind of arrangement where you would stash the child with a nice nurse in the countryside and you'd say to yourself, oh, my child's getting lots of fresh air. I think it was something that a lot of people resorted to. And so that led me into the hidden world of Victorian baby farms. And some some of them were really utterly hideous. Quite a few of them had a distinction between two rooms, where in one room were the babies who were being paid for by the week, so there was some motivation to keep them alive. And then they had another room for the babies who were all paid up. They had just been handed over with a lump sum. And, you know, it's that kind of moment where you suddenly feel that no matter how understandable the people in historical fiction are, sometimes, you know, there are aspects of their mindset that strike us as utterly alien. So that's something I love about setting novels in the past, that your reader is all cozy with your characters, and then every now and then your reader flinches away from how very different they were.
Mm. And also, I mean, that is a life moment of having to do with a child that is devastating, and something that it would seem that no one really could remove themselves from entirely.
Yes, and I think I'm just very interested in looking at motherhood not just as the kind of default position, the natural, easy thing that happens, but motherhood under crisis. And so in Room, I look at one particular angle of a woman giving birth to a child in a locked room where she's been kidnapped. And you might say somebody like Blanche swanning around 1870 San Francisco has a lot of freedom, but in a way she's committed herself to this lifestyle of being, you know, the entertaining, pretty, good time girl. And that doesn't really allow for motherhood either. So she's pulled in two very different directions, and it's a painful process.
So tell us a little bit about Jenny Bonnet and this woman who is able to really is a fascinating woman. She is funny. She's got a lot going on. She's able to crack jokes but very intelligent and has a very stark sensibility to her.
A lot of what I characterize Jenny as like was suggested by the sources. For instance, even negative evidence. In the sources, nobody mentions her lodging anywhere. Nobody gives an address at any point for her. So that made me think, okay, maybe she's not living anywhere in particular. Maybe she just sort of couch surfs around town. And in two of the newspaper articles, even if they're only very small, she's recorded as joking with the judge or joking with the reporters. You know, she says things like, you know, she was regularly arrested for cross-dressing. And she joked with the judge saying, well, you know, if you don't want me to wear pants in the evening, I'll have to go naked because I don't have any other clothes. So she was like a vaudeville star, but on the streets. And there was a lot of cross-dressing in the 19th century, but it was usually done in a very sort of desperate, keep your hat down, don't get found out sort of way. You know, women passing as men in order to have jobs. But Jenny Bonnet was doing it in this very modern, playful way. She was a known character around town. She was a known cross-dresser. So she wasn't trying to trick anyone, but she constantly courted attention and celebrity. She would get drunk and pick fights in bars and, you know, wave her cult pistol around. And one of the tiny facts I found in the source was that after her death, it turned out the pistol had belonged to a pawnbroker. So even that was borrowed glamour, you know. So even though the sources were only very fragmentary and they contradicted each other, it gave me a lot of suggestions for the character of Jenny and just that peculiarly modern sensibility she had to play games with gender in a way which is probably routine in the streets of San Francisco today, but was not at all in mid-Victorian times.
And how does she become, you write about it, of course, but how does she become connected with frogs?
Well, she had been a shepherd, and before that she was in a reform school. Before that she was a child actor. So she had clearly, in a way, rejected the you know, selling of your feminine charms type of career. And she clearly loved nature. So I don't know, she just seemed to have ended up supplying frogs to restaurants. Her former boyfriend was a chef, so I imagine that was a connection. But basically the French in San Francisco cornered the market in the trades of pleasure generally. They ran restaurants, they ran bars, theatres and brothels. So the English had brought in this foreign miners tax to try and squeeze all other nationalities out of the gold mining trade. But one of the ironies of gold rushes is that typically you make more money by being a shopkeeper and selling services to the poor sucker miners instead of actually doing the digging. So the French certainly flourished in San Francisco on that basis.
The story is told in such an interesting way because Blanche is going back and forth telling us, of course, of what is happening and solving this mystery, but also going back to talking about her earlier life. And you wanted those two dimensions to the character.
Definitely. And one review described them as sort of like two trains bearing down on us. I wanted there to be a wonderful tension in the jumping back and forward in time because it's not just a murder mystery. I mean, I tried to make it really work as a murder mystery, but of course it's a literary novel as well. So in a way, Blanche is trying to solve the mystery of who Jenny was, because Jenny is very resistant to questions and is always, you know, turning them aside with a joke. But also it becomes the story of Blanche trying to find her missing baby and Blanche trying to find, in a way, the missing mother in her. So I tried to have it work on several levels, that in a way Blanche is pulled in several directions by this attempt to, you know, be loyal to herself and be loyal to her dead friend and be loyal to her baby.
Emma Donoghue is our guest on the book show this week. The title of the new novel is Frog Music. It is published by Little Brown. Music is very much a part of this story.
So much so, yes. I mean, I knew once I'd come up with the title, which, by the way, refers to the kind of, you know, grunting of a lot of horny male frogs, I thought, oh, I'll throw a few songs in there. But as soon as I started selecting songs, they just jumped out at me. So I ended up with almost 30 songs quoted in the text. It helped that almost all my characters are performers. You know, Blanche and her friends are all from the circus in Paris, and Jenny was a child actor. But also people just sang in those days. They just burst into song in public places with no embarrassment. And I thought song was a great way to suggest the melting pot of San Francisco. And also, I love the way folk songs, you know, change a little bit in every generation and as they encounter other musical styles. Music is inherently social. So the songs turned out to be a wonderful way to suggest those cultural mixtures without, you know, I hate when historical fiction grinds to a halt and the author puts in an explanatory paragraph. I was determined to avoid all that. So I found the music a graceful way to do it. And actually on the audiobook, the actress bursts into song every time there's a song bit in the text. So I really look forward to that. That'll add a whole other dimension.
I know I've talked to Nick Hornby about this and other authors who incorporate music, Michael Chabon being another one who incorporate a lot of music.
Oh, yes, Telegraph Avenue.
Absolutely. And that in the writing process, Roddy Doyle as well, that in the writing process, music is very much a part of that process. While they're writing, the music is playing and there's almost a soundtrack to the process. Was that the case for you?
Yes, I didn't have music on just as background, but every time I was interested in including a song in the text, I would look up multiple versions of it on iTunes. And it was fascinating to hear how different those versions could be. You know, somebody like Bruce Springsteen will take a gospel song, basically, like This Little Light of Mine, and it'll turn out into this big barnstorming track. So it's just fascinating to listen to different versions and to realize that music, like, say, fairy tales, folk music is endlessly adaptable to the needs of each generation. And you even see the lyrics changing over time. Like there's a great Pete Seeger track about, you know, who's going to tie your pretty shoes. And in the early versions, it's, the male speaker says, I'm going to be your man. But then you suddenly find a new version that says, and I don't need no man. So there the song has literally turned around and, changed its premises. So I found the music a really rich element of this book, and I would love to do that kind of thing again.
I want to get back to Blanche, this character, the survivor of this shooting. She's young, she's a dancer, a prostitute, as you mentioned, and she is sort of along for the ride there for a while until she then decides that she's going to go on this search and become very active in the process. And I'm curious as to how you brought her to that point of wanting to take defined action.
Sure. Well, I think it's always fun to start with a character who thinks their life is just fine. And then, you know, you set off an earthquake, you cause havoc in that character's life and you make them change everything. So because I've written a novel about a prostitute before, my first historical novel, Slammerkin, in that story, it was a teenage prostitute and the trade was clearly brutalizing and numbing to her. It was just hideous, a kind of grim economic transaction. So I thought this time I wanted a different angle, and I thought it would be quite fun to take Blanche and have her think that her life is just great, that she is running the trade rather than the trade running her. And only the sort of, you know, stimulating contact of becoming friends with Jenny Bonney starts to make her ask questions. I liked the idea of a sort of accidental friendship, which has such effects on both lives, that one woman ends up dead and one woman ends up transformed by it. So I thought also you could make much subtler ethical points about the sex trade. If you start with a situation where this highly paid woman feels confident and successful, and she, when she's doing her dances, she feels like she has all the power. And so it's actually a much more interesting transformation for her to realize that there are moments when she's selling what she shouldn't be selling. You know, she finds she needs to say no, no further, not this, not now.
As you mentioned, you've written about prostitution before. What about it as a subject do you think lures you?
It is funny that I've written about it so much. I think it's that it symbolizes other jobs. You know, it seems sometimes the most kind of elemental trade. You know, what did the first cave woman ever sell? I think that's what it would have been. And it raises such interesting issues in whatever time or place you're writing about, because the circumstances can be so different. I mean, for instance, Blanche is operating at the kind of, you know, high level courtesan or escort girl end of things. But she's sitting on the streetcar and she sees some of the crib girls. Those are the girls from the notorious cribs where you would just lie down on a little cot and service 10 men in an hour. So there's no one thing called prostitution. So nowadays, if you're talking about, you know, well-paid escort girls, that's so different from if you're talking about, you know, trafficked underage kids. So I just find it a really interesting area for questions about, you know, gender and money.
I'm curious as to the location. Obviously, the story takes place in San Francisco, so that brings you to San Francisco. What was the research of that like? You are, of course, Irish, born in Dublin, now live in Canada. How much of a stretch was it for you to envision San Francisco at that time, and how much does current San Francisco give you a window into that former world?
I didn't take much from current San Francisco, because really the architecture of Chinatown is all completely different after the earthquake. What I got from looking at San Francisco today is the spirit of liberty. It's always been so proud of that. It's always been a haven for oddballs and for homeless. People end up in San Francisco. It's the sort of end of the line. And the layout of the city, the physical exuberance of those hills is something that appealed to me too. But mostly I found old San Francisco in texts. Say, I found a great sort of travel guide to San Francisco in 1876, writing by people like Mark Twain. And in particular, photographs were a crucial source, like, say, Arnold Gente, a Prussian immigrant. He took a lot of pictures of old Chinatown, where you can see the balconies almost meet overhead, you know, an incredibly, you know, closely packed and dirty ghetto. Dirty because the city wouldn't provide any garbage removal services. So in a way, it was in photographs that I found that whole lost world of, say, the Palace Hotel, this extraordinarily huge hotel where Blanche would meet her clients, and the burlesque and dance world. Promotional postcards would show me their crazy costumes that they wore, with things like, you know, armored breastplates or bows and arrows or a horse's head costume. So a lot of that world of, say, burlesque dancing, I couldn't possibly have conjured up without photography. So this is the first novel I've written in which photography was just a crucial source.
You mentioned the impact that the earthquake had on the architecture, but as you talk about in the afterword of the book, it also has an impact on the records. There aren't many records left after the earthquake to source this story, except for 50-60 newspaper articles.
Yes, luckily newspapers, you know, were published and distributed to different areas, so they didn't get all lost in the earthquake. At first, I suppose I felt a little daunted that I wasn't going to find police records about Jenny's many arrests. But then I realized that not only did newspapers give me a lot, but that also these apparently boring looking municipal reports that the city published every year, which are now accessible online, they contained fascinating sort of aggregated information about, say, how many arrests for public drunkenness that year, 3,000. How many arrests for cross-dressing? One, which was Jenny. So even without her being named, I could get a huge amount of information from the fact that she was the only one being persecuted under this law. She was a little local celebrity. It was kind of a cat and mouse game. The police would say, oh, there she is, let's arrest her again. So you learn to be very... you learn horizontal thinking, you know. If you can't find your information one way, you look for it in another. And I had to be terribly patient in examining, say, online databases with census records and so on, because they all spell their names differently. And journalists had no standards in those days. Misspelling was just the norm. They were terribly slapdash. And then, of course, print is smeary as well. And then a lot of these databases have used optical character recognition to turn handwriting into print. And the result is practically gibberish. So I had to do a huge amount of peering at screens and zooming in and endlessly searching for the surnames of my main characters. I had a great insight at one point. I realized I couldn't find Blanche Benoit, the dancer, anywhere in records of anyone who came to San Francisco. So I suddenly thought Blanche sounds a bit like a stage name. That sounds like the kind of name a dancer would adopt. So I decided to look for, you know, just blank Benoit. And there I found her. Her name was Adele Benoit. So, you know, moments like that, they might seem petty to an outsider, but for a writer doing this kind of fact-based fiction, they're just thrilling. It's like, I found her.
And you admit, in the afterword, that there were characters that really inhabited a gray area that was difficult to find anything on.
Indeed. For instance, the sinister madam. I knew any story about prostitution would have to have a sinister madam in it. So I decided to model her on the nuns who educated me in Dublin, you know, very austere and sort of managerial and wanting the best for their charges. I thought it would be great to transfer those nun-like qualities to a madam. But all I knew about the real Madam Joanna is that her brothel was known for having virgin auctions. And the age of consent at the time in California was 10. So they would literally auction off the virginity of these girls who they claimed were 10, could have been even younger. It's a stomach-churning detail, but it told me a lot of what I needed to know about Madame Joanna. Similarly, with these, I needed a sinister baby farmer to provide, childcare services. And so I chose Doctress Hoffman. And one of the few things I knew about this woman was that she got into an argument in the street with a mother who was leaving her baby farm with the baby. And she tried to rip the baby's tiny nightshirt off. And she kept saying, the nightshirt belongs to me. So again, it's only one detail, but it told me all I needed to know about this hag who was making money from providing every different service from adoption to abortion to childcare. So sometimes with sources like these, you know, the less you have, the richer the effects are. A whole fictional scene springs to life in your head because you just have this one little nugget of fact. So I don't think I needed my sources to be any fuller than they were because they were just so stimulating to my imagination.
Without giving anything away, I am curious when you think of the case, when you think of the story, how much do you think you got right?
I couldn't swear that I got the explanation of the murder right, but I think my version is certainly far more plausible than that of the police who years later pinned the whole thing on a dead Canadian. That was just too convenient for me. A foreigner and dead already doesn't ring true. So I think my version is pretty plausible, and I certainly think it's based on very real aspects of the time. You know, the dynamics between family members, the limited options for the poor, the way people kind of, you know, delegate their dirty work. I think I'd back my version against any other I've heard.
What is next for you? Have you moved on to a new novel?
I'm writing a children's novel, actually, a contemporary children's novel, so a completely different world. I like to set myself a different task with each book, you see. And in Frog Music, I was quite intimidated by the need for it to be a real valid murder mystery. And similarly, writing for kids now, I feel a bit like, oh, kids might hate it. But also, I've been working on the screenplay of Room. I'm working very closely with an Irish company, and we're casting the film right now. And so we hope to film that later this year. And that's been a fascinating project to kind of translate the magic of fiction into cinema, which is a very different medium.
Are you advising or are you screenwriting?
Oh, I'm the screenwriter, yeah. And I'm an executive producer as well.
And that gives you the control that I assume you feel most comfortable.
Control would be going too far. It gives me a voice. It gives me input. Yes. Control, no, probably not control.
The title of the new novel is Frog Music. It is published by Little Brown. Emma Donahue, a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Emma Donahue's new novel, again, is Frog Music. It is published by Little Brown. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.